Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel on the New Books feed. Today I have Andrew Lay. Andrew is a shadow minister for Treasury and Charities and federal minister for Fenner in the Australian Parliament. Prior to being elected in 2010, Andrew was a professor of economics at the Australian National University. He holds a PhD in public policy from Harvard, having graduated from the University of Sydney with first class honors in arts and law. Andrew is a fellow of the Australian Academy of Social Sciences and a past recipient of the Young Economist Award, a prize given every 2 years by the Economic Society of Australia to the best economist under 40. This is pretty impressive. His books include Disconnected, Battlers and Billionaires, The Economics of Just About Everything, The Lux of Politics, Choosing Openness, Why Global Engagement is Best for Australia, today's book, Randomistas, How Radical Researchers Changed Our World, which came out in 2018 from Yale University Press, and Innovation and Inequality, How to Create a Future That is More Star Trek Than Terminator. Andrew is a keen marathon runner and hosts a podcast entitled The Good Life, Andrew Lay in Conversation, which is available on Apple Podcasts. So Andrew, welcome to the show. If you want to start by telling us where you came up with this idea for your book and filling in any details that your biography did not cover, things that you think are important about you as a researcher that the audience might like to know about, that would be great.
Well, thanks, Sydney, for a most generous introduction and for the chance to talk about randomized trials, which I'll grab any day of the week. To the extent that I've got one big idea about social policy, it's the notion that we ought to be optimistic about tackling the big challenges, whether that is gaps between minority and majority groups, achieving full employment, reducing the scourge of chronic illness, but scientific and critical about how we go about getting there. We need to recognise that many of the ideas that look really promising coming out of the lab turn out not to work in reality. So only 1 out of 10 cancer drugs makes it all the way through stage 1, 2, 3 trials into the market. And the same is true when rigorous evaluations are done of ideas that come about in the tech sector or notions in education. So I think we need to build a better feedback loop. And for me, randomized trials are doing that. It's the way in which we test new drugs. And increasingly, they're being rolled out through development economics. The Nobel Prize this year went to 3 development economists who have been pioneering randomized trials as a way of better assisting people in low-income countries to raise their living standards.
Wonderful. So just to step back a little bit, because I'm very excited about random controls trials. I know a lot of economists are, a lot of people all over the sciences are quite excited. But for our listeners, in case people aren't up to date, what exactly is an RCT or a randomized control trial? And can you explain why it is that they're so promising?
Sure. Well, let's use an example that's on everyone's minds right now, testing potential new vaccines for coronavirus. We want to make sure that these vaccines work before we roll them out to the population at large. So as good ideas come out of the laboratory, they're being administered to people with by the toss of a coin. Heads, you get the vaccine that we think is going to work. Tails, you get a salt solution, essentially a nothing drug, a placebo. And then we look to see whether those the infection rates are different across those two groups. This is how we tested the polio vaccine in 1954. We randomly injected 600,000 American children with either polio vaccine or salt water. It worked, and the next year, immunization of all American children began. It's how we tested streptomycin, one of the treatments that helped massively reduce the death toll from tuberculosis in the 1940s. And increasingly, if you want to get public funding for a new drug in an advanced country, you need to have a randomized trial behind it to show that the drug really works.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this right, for our audience, essentially for an RCT to work, you take a group of people who are willing volunteers, you randomly split them up between two groups. The point of the randomness is that there can be no differences between or systemic differences between the two groups, because there's nothing predicting which group they're in versus the other. And use one group as a counterfactual to another group. Sorry, I'm going over this a couple times because when I learned it, it took me a couple of tries, but I think it's one of like the most powerful ideas that there is out there, which is why I decided to read Andrew's book and bring it to you. But so you highlighted the polio rollout. Your book is actually largely, I highly recommend people read it. It's largely a collection of RCT results. Do you have a couple favorites you'd like to highlight?
Well, there's some that I use in my own life. I used to take a daily multivitamin tablet until I read a synthesis of randomized trials, which showed for otherwise healthy people, multivitamin tablets don't make you live any longer. I used to take a daily fish oil tablet, and then I read a randomized trial showing that that doesn't seem to do anything for your heart. When I finish a marathon, I put on a pair of compression socks because a nice randomized trial of marathon runners showed that those randomly assigned to wear compression socks recovered faster than those who didn't get the compression socks. And when I've got to take a Band-Aid off the skin of one of my three boys, I use the fast method rather than the slow method, buoyed by a randomized trial at James Cook University that showed that the amount of pain you experience when a Band-Aid is removed fast is less than when it's removed slowly.
That's actually quite interesting. When I read that, I actually decided that the next time I had to put on a Band-Aid, I'm going to try it on myself, or maybe I'll flip a coin and try it on myself and see if it works.
Self-experimentation has a long history, Sydney, and a distinguished one at that.
Yes. Speaking of that, would you tell us about the case of scurvy? I found that to be a particularly enlightening opening.
So scurvy was the result of a very young naval surgeon, James Lind, who was faced with a whole range of theories as to what might work to tackle scurvy. Vinegar, salt water, guts, which is about as bad as it sounds, and the one we know that works, citrus. He applied it to a dozen men separated into pairs, and then looked to see what the effect was upon them. And it turned out that those who got citrus did far better. And that was part of the reason that the British Navy adopted citrus, taking a whole lot of barrels of citrus onto each of its ships. Indeed, part of the reason that Nelson won the Battle of Trafalgar was that the British fleet was not affected by scurvy, whereas the French and Spanish fleets were.
So you're telling me that we could put a picture of a surgeon and some scurvy references at Trafalgar Square instead of Nelson and HMS Victory?
That would be absolutely. The randomisters are behind a whole lot of important breakthroughs. And indeed, when we're looking at saving lives today, an important randomized trial looked at whether or not it was better to ask people to pay a small amount for a anti-malarial bed net. There'd been a theory that if people didn't pay for them, then they wouldn't use them. But large-scale randomized trials across half a dozen African countries showed conclusively that free bed nets had the same take-up. It were just as likely to be used and had much higher take-up. And so bed nets are now distributed free rather than for a modest co-payment. Again, randomisters saving lives.
That's actually fascinating. So let's talk about, obviously, every good thing has at least some drawbacks. So the first thing to talk about is, could you go over the placebo effects, what it is, and then we'll get into some of the ethical issues that it raises with, particularly in medicine?
So the placebo effect is the notion that when you think you're getting a good treatment, you can feel better. It turns out to be modest in the case of drugs. We know that, for example, patients who get a yellow tablet are less likely to be depressed. This is a yellow sugar tablet. Those who want to reduce their anxiety, if you give them a green tablet, that'll reduce their anxiety. We also know there's a placebo effect which applies with surgery. So a majority of patients who undergo surgery feel better. But that's true also even when it's what's called sham surgery, in which after patient consent, half the patients are cut open and then sutured closed again without any surgery being performed. The power of that white lab white coat and the authority of the surgeon seems to convey quite a big placebo effect. So we want to strip that out in order to look at the true effect of the intervention.
Okay. And to get that to happen, it raises some interesting ethical questions because, as you mentioned, sham surgery sort of, I guess at least culturally, it seems scary, if not raising genuine ethical questions, that I might go to the doctor and the doctor might perform a surgery on me that is really just opening up my body, you know, I guess popping a cold one and then sewing it shut. I'm aware that's not how that happens, but it's sort of, I guess, it terrifies us because it changes the way that we have this construction of how medicine works, that I guess destroys this effect that we get from the placebo. Could you talk about some of the actual ethical checks that go behind sham surgery? Because this seems like something that confused a lot of people, and that actually, if people better understood and didn't misunderstand, be able to have better outcomes.
So sham surgery occurs in instances in which surgeons aren't sure whether or not the surgery is better than the next available alternative, such as, for example, physical therapy in recovery. And what happens is a very rigorous ethical procedure. So the patient is told that because they're not sure whether the surgery works, they can opt in to a sham surgery trial. If they're in the sham surgery trial, then there's a 50% chance they'll get the actual procedure, a 50% chance that they'll receive the easy listening music, the anaesthetic and the slices and sutures, but without actually getting the surgery itself. A surprisingly large share of patients consent to this, and nurses go back and ask them again just to be absolutely sure, and they get them to sign forms. But it's really important because it's finding, for example, with operations such as the meniscectomy, which is a knee surgery that's performed millions of times a year, that for regular middle-aged patients, it doesn't seem to be any more effective than sham surgery. And that's also true of a range of other common surgical procedures, which involve significant recovery times for patients, but also huge expense for us in the community, Sydney. So it's really important that we find out whether these surgeries work, and when they don't, that we take those resources and deploy them elsewhere.
I guess the ethics of that are the more scarier part, but yes, I can clearly see how valuable that would be. Speaking of,
but why are you concerned it's unethical? If we're not sure that the surgery works, I would have thought it might be you could have unethical not to do a rigorous evaluation of it and just to continue on based on nothing more than theory and eminence.
Oh, to be clear for our audience, I don't believe it's unethical. My belief is that it feels scary, if that makes sense. It's one of those things intuitively is scarier than it actually is if you think about it.
I think that's right. Yeah, although the randomist surgeons I chatted to were some of the most modest surgeons I've ever met. And they made the point to me, Sydney, that often in surgery, people regard aggressive surgeons as heroic and conservative surgeons as cowardly. And they said that's just completely mistaken, that often the best thing to do is not to operate rather than to operate. And sometimes randomized trials can bring a bit of science to that decision. it's easy to forget that for most of human history, you've been safer off not going to see the doctor than going to see the doctor. And it's only thanks to the randomized revolution that now the healthier option is to go and see the doc. Before that, things like bloodletting and leeches and all manner of hocus pocus meant you're actually much better staying away.
Speaking of it being scarier to go to the doctor, would you tell our audience the story from the Vienna Hospital of Women Giving Birth?
Ah, yes, this is one of my favorites. And so there was a Vienna hospital in which the rate of deaths when patients were admitted on days when surgeons were there seemed to be much higher than when they were admitted at times when the nurses and midwives were on duty. And it wasn't immediately clear what was going on because this is before the germ theory of disease. But it had turned out eventually that the surgeons were coming from conducting autopsies to delivering babies without properly washing their hands beforehand. And so the death rate was considerably higher as a result of surgical intervention than it was when the midwives and nurses were on duty. Of course, the high status profession, the doctors, poo-pooed the idea that they could be causing these problems. But the fact that you had a sort of artificial randomized trial going on, women were showing up on midwife days or doctor days according to chance rather than because they were choosing to, meant that the results were pretty hard to dismiss and ultimately helped lead to a movement of doctors washing their hands, which took much longer than it should have.
Can you just to finish the story, tell our audience why it ended up taking 50 more years of them ignoring the trial and how it is that randomized trials came to be seen as critical and more necessary than they may have been in the past?
Yeah, so the comparison I always enjoy is the one between anesthetics and hand washing among surgery. Anesthetics comes in and within a couple of years, all the surgeons are using them because it's much more pleasant to operate on a patient who is unconscious than a patient who is screaming their head off. But hand washing is conversely quite painful for particularly using those early chlorine-based washers. And so doctors are very resistant to the work of people like Semmelweis, who showed early on that there was a good effect for the patients, but at the cost of surgeons having quite painfully cracked hands, as I'm sure many of your listeners have right now, as we've all been doing this additional hand washing to protect ourselves against coronavirus.
Thanks for that. That actually, I think, segues into my next thing I'd like to talk about is, can you tell some of the stories about resistance to RCTs and acceptance of RCTs? One of the critical points you argue in the book, at least in my reading, is that you should always push for RCTs and you should always take the risks necessary to do them. You've talked about housing programs that had to turn people away randomly, which again, they were concerned to do, but turned out to be really helpful in evaluating the program. So can you talk about some of like the human side of putting these into practice and some wins and losses that go along with that?
Yeah, so the Moving to Opportunity study, which is carried out in the early 1990s, was a sort of a naturally occurring randomized trial. Researchers were interested to see what the effect of place was on families' life chances. Sociologists for many years had hypothesized that it isn't just your personal resources, it's also your neighbours make a difference. And the Moving for Opportunity study took advantage of an additional amount of funding that was available for new housing vouchers that would require someone to move to a lower poverty neighbourhood. The researchers ran a randomised trial and initially saw surprisingly little effect. There didn't seem to be much of an impact of moving to a low poverty neighbourhood on outcomes like whether the parent worked or the average test scores of the children. It was only a couple of decades after the trial had initially been conducted that researchers came back and started to ask the question, well, maybe the kids who were youngest when they'd moved had a different impact than the kids who were older.
Maybe if you your family moved home when you were two, then it's a different impact on your life chances than if your family moved when you're 17. And indeed, when you look at it that way, it turned out there was quite a big effect of changing neighbourhood. This reflects one of the other ways in which randomised trials have increasingly powered up, which is by linking to administrative data. Governments hold a whole lot of data on us, and randomised trials that are able to take advantage of tapping into those large databases with the consent of the participants are able to really keep the costs down. So it's a mistake to think that every randomised trial needs to take decades and cost millions. In fact, a whole lot of low-cost randomised trials are now being done for tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars that provide really critical insights in social policy.
Yeah, so randomised trials have a reputation for being more expensive, at least for young economists, because you have to find funding to fund them. They do cost more than, I guess, opening your laptop and running some regressions. But I would be interested if you could give our audience some sense of the types of cost-benefit analysis that come with these, because they're incredibly promising, and like the ratios of value to cost. Would you give our listeners a sense of that?
Absolutely. So there's a study called Perry Preschool, which looks at the impact of high-quality early childhood programs on the life chances of people in a very disadvantaged community in America starting in the 1960s. That found that for every dollar that was spent on the children, $7 was saved, largely through averted felonies. Those who went through the program were much less likely to commit a felony than those who didn't. But it's also important to remember that on the other end of the scale, randomised trials can be amazingly cheap and simple. We were talking before about self-experimentation. When I was coming up with the subtitle for Randomisters, I ran a simple experiment on Google. I ran Google ads with all the various possible randomised trials, including some that my editors liked, some that I liked, some that my mother suggested. I found that the worst performing title was Randomisters, How a Powerful Tool Changed Our World. The best performer is Randomisters, How Radical Researchers Changed Our World. It took about an hour to set up, cost me about $50, and I had around 4,000 people looking at the advertisements and clicking or not clicking on them. So you can run really simple randomized trials, and indeed companies like Netflix and Amazon and Google are doing that all the time.
Yes. So can you talk a little bit more about the application of RCTs in the private sector and some of the pushback that came with that for customers not wanting to be experimented on, and some of the places that holds promise and potential issues that you see?
Yeah, there's a huge number of firms that are now experimenting with what they call A/B testing. So eBay, Intuit, Humana, Chrysler, United Airlines, Lyft and Uber. There's one US executive who says that his firm has three cardinal rules. Don't harass women, don't steal, and you've got to have a control group. In other words, you can lose your job for not having a control group. One of my favorite studies is one that Google did, trying to optimize the shade of blue that they would use for their toolbar. Marissa Mayer, who was then a vice president at Google, tested 40 different shades of blue, they estimated that because they're getting so many clicks, optimizing the shade of blue adds about $200 million to Google's bottom line. And that illustrates another point, I think, Sydney, which is that Google has more data than anyone else on the planet. Yeah, 40,000 searches a second, 15 exabytes of data. But they still do it using random assignment, because just having a lot of data doesn't allow you to discern whether or not things work. You actually need random assignment in order to be able to tell the wheat from the chaff.
That's awesome. Can you tell me a little bit more about, I know that there was a price experiment with Amazon and the limits of random trials. I'm attempting to see if we can get at the issue of in medicine, we consent to random trials. Online, we don't. And it can sort of feel weird to be experimented on.
That's right. So Amazon, a decade or so ago, carried out an experiment in which it began randomly varying prices in order to see what effect it would have. This happens all the time in stores. If you want to know why about half of all published prices end in 9, that's because randomized trials conducted by marketers have determined that prices ending in 9 produce the highest profits for the firm. But when Amazon started doing it for exactly the same product, effectively telling two customers who are otherwise identical they would pay different prices for the same product, they copped a significant consumer backlash. That led Amazon to promise that never again would they run these kinds of pricing experiments. What's amusing, however, is that there are a whole range of third-party firms who operate an Amazon marketplace with exactly that business model. So it's true that Amazon's own published prices aren't experiments on their users, but if you're on marketplace, that rule no longer applies. And a whole lot of firms use marketplace in order to work out not only what price works best, but also how to vary their description and so to get it right, which photos best produce the most sales. These sort of experiments are happening all the time. Pretty much any time you turn on your computer and use the internet, you're part of randomized trials.
So you started with the example of marketers doing an RCT and coming up with the fact that all prices should end in 9. But as all prices start to end in 9, not just the ones they experimented on, it's possible the effect wears off. Could you elaborate more on these problems of general equilibrium effects, as we call them in economics, and ways that one might get around them or ways that they may limit RCTs?
That's a great example, actually, of general equilibrium effect. So this is the idea, Sydney, for those of you readers, listeners who aren't immediately familiar with it, that something that works for a small group might not scale up to a large group. So you might have a job training program which helps the participants, but at the expense of the rest of society. One way of doing that is to do it at a large scale. There's a randomized trial which was looking at the rollout of biometrically identified smart cards in India, which had a sample size of 19 million people. And because ultimately everyone in the state received a biometric smart card, it was able to look at not only at the impact on fraud and welfare uptake of those who received it, but also at these spillover effects. So the best randomized trials are operating at scale or have something else like a natural experiment to look at the overall aggregate effect in the population, these general equilibrium effects. Sometimes we're not as worried about them, but certainly there's cases in which you want to think about those spillovers potentially reducing the true impact.
Fair enough. It's just something to consider because all tools have their limitations. So changing gears a little bit, there was a story, and given that it's an election year, I'll ask you to tell it, about children in East Rock, Connecticut, who were having a little political experiment done on them during trick-or-treat. Would you be so kind as to share that? I found it amusing.
So this is one of my friends, Dean Carlin, who is an inveterate randomister. I suspect if they'd given the Nobel Prize last year to 4 people, then Dean Carlin would have joined Michael Kremer, Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo in getting the Nobel Prize. He mostly does sort of high-powered, important experiments in development economics, but when he was in a neighborhood where there were hordes of children hitting the front door for Halloween, just in election season, he couldn't resist seeing whether or not children would go to the side of the house that was decorated in Republican colors. This is in a highly Democratic neighborhood, so he could start from the assumption that most children were supporters of the Democratic candidate. So he did up one side of the house with John McCain materials, the other side with Barack Obama materials, and then saw how much more candy you had to offer to children in order to get them to go to the Republican side rather than the Democratic side. It's a lovely little example on working out the degree to which a little bit of extra candy will help children overcome their partisan hue.
That's amusing. It really is. But it gets me to something, I guess, that's a little bit scarier or bigger or more worthy of consideration. is that if these little behavioral quirks that we can identify with RCTs change what we do, is there a concern that it's not just people who are attempting to do good with or good for us are using these? And is there a way to counteract that effect? Or is that just going to be part of living in a world with much more access to data, much more access to data literate people, much more computing power, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, we should be careful about the notion that randomized trials are always good. Just like any other tool, they can be misused by people seeking to do the wrong thing. In this case, I think it's vital to ensure that people are getting informed consent anytime a researcher is looking to publish a study. I think it's also vital to ensure that there's pre-registration of trials, because there's been some instances of people cherry-picking results afterwards. And increasingly, that's being systematized in the social sciences in a way that it has been in medicine for many years. But again, building a better feedback loop is fundamentally taking a more modest approach to the world. It's recognizing the limits of our ignorance and where theory can take us and where theory stops being useful. So I think of randomized trials very much as being where modesty meets numeracy.
Fair. So you talked about a little bit earlier about your friend Dean Karlan. And as we're talking about the limits of theory, particularly as an economist, it was a big deal when Esther and Abhijit got the Nobel Prize. Not just, can you talk a little bit about the shift in the social sciences disciplines and where you see this going? And just what this means for people who are building the theories that we read about in the newspaper, and how that might look different in 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, the best of randomized trials don't throw theory aside. In fact, they're very closely tied to theory. So in a way, it used to be the case that economists, when they wanted to test their theories, would go out and look for a natural experiment in the world, which sometimes wasn't a particularly good test of the theory. What's great about randomized trials is you can tailor the test to be quite an accurate representation of the underlying theory. So, for example, you might have a notion that in order to encourage business startup rates, you need a combination of access to capital and know-how. To test that, you can run a two-way randomized trial in which some people get nothing, some people get training, some people get cash, some people get cash and training. And that allows you to test whether or not the ability to start a business relies on both capital and training. So we need this careful testing, not just of programs and ideas. You know, are people more likely to open something in a red envelope than a blue envelope, but also deeper economic concepts. And I think that's the real success of the randomized trials revolution, where it's building up our deep understanding of how the world works, not just giving a tick or a cross to a particular program.
On the issue of building a deeper understanding of how the world works, you have a phrase that you've used several times, and it's a chapter of your book. It's called Building a Better Feedback Loop. Could you give our audience a little insight into how someone who is not an economist, not a scientist maybe at all, could build a better feedback loop in their own life to solve maybe more mundane problems or more person-specific problems, or to just, I guess, live a better life?
Yeah, so there's no reason you can't do randomized trials on yourself. If you there's a particular tablet that you wonder whether or not it'll make you feel better each day, then you can take one on random days and note down how you feel. If there's particular foods that you're not quite sure about, come up with a random schedule, write yourself toss a coin for each day of the month, and then try eating the food on certain days, not eating on other days, and see how it makes you feel or look. But also just be aware that a lot of the research that is published, frighteningly, some of the even work that's published in top journals can be wrong if it's not based on a good underlying identification strategy. So the randomized trials revolution is moving us away from the notion of what they call the HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion, towards getting evidence based on really rigorous counterfactual, in which we're sure that, as you said before, because the two groups ex ante are the same, if we see a difference ex post between the treatment and control group, we know that it's the treatment that's making a difference. That's been broadly accepted in medicine for decades, even centuries, but it's only now starting to come into other areas like business and social science.
So as it drips its way into business and social science, I think me and the rest of our audience are hoping that it will also drift its way into public policy and our political process. Could you talk about how your background as a scientist and your understanding of randomized trials and your belief in their promise affects your work as a politician and some of the issues or maybe pushback or celebration that you've gotten for attempting to bring this type of science into political work?
Yeah, so I'm a strong supporter of randomized trials. I've talked my colleagues ear off about them. And indeed, when we went to the last election in Australia, we were unsuccessful ultimately, but my party, the Labor Party, took a policy of creating an evaluator general, which would have had a mandate to do more randomized trials right across government in order to get a better sense as to what works and what doesn't. That follows the example of what's been done in other countries, from Sweden to the United States to Canada to New Zealand, a notion that we need in government a little bit more scientifically driven approaches to problems, particularly when there's a broad agreement as to what we're trying to achieve. So if there's recognition that a high-quality test captures what we're aiming to achieve in school, or that we unambiguously want to increase the school attendance rate, then having settled on that outcome, let's now rigorously use the best scientific approaches to test what works to get us there.
Is there pushback against the idea of building an evaluator general, or is this just something no one has thought about before? I can't think of good reasons not to do it.
That's right. I suppose the pushback comes sometimes from people who say these problems are so urgent, we just have to get on and act on them straight away, to which my response is, well, they've been urgent for decades now. We've needed to act on them straight away for decades now, but we've been getting it wrong. So let's focus on getting it right. The other pushback that comes is a question of ethics. How can we deny a needy person a potentially effective solution? And so getting that ethical piece right is important, making sure that those implementing the randomized trial are aware of why we're excluding half the people from receiving the treatment. You're not going to get a good randomized trial if you don't have proper buy-in from everyone involved.
Okay. I mean, that all makes sense, and I'm glad that it is coming to policy. So we've taken up a lot of your time today, which I really appreciate. Would you tell our audience a little bit more about where they can find you, listen to your podcast, also what you're working on next? This is our traditional final question at New Books Network, so that our audience continue to follow you if they enjoyed what they heard today.
Fabulous. Well, I'm easily findable at the modestly named andrewlee.com, andrewleigh.com. I send out a monthly newsletter, which people can sign up to there, or they can listen to the podcast, The Good Life, Andrew Lee in Conversation, which is on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and all the other good places you find your podcasts. Next project is of course working with my parliamentary colleagues on holding the government to account through this sort of unprecedented period in which we're living at the moment. It really is an extraordinary time to be in public life as we watch the coronavirus crisis unfold as both a health and an economic crisis. My colleague Joshua Gans and I have just put out a book called Innovation and Equality, How to Create a Future That's More Star Trek Than Terminator. And I'm very, very much thinking about those issues and how we manage to have a society that is both more egalitarian and more innovative, which I think are qualities that are sorely needed today.
That's excellent, Andrew. Thank you very much for coming on our podcast. And as always, to our audience, Stay posted. There'll be more New Books in Economics coming soon.